League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cutforth, and special guest, the fifth Sci Guy, Noah Fintz.
Number five!
This week, we're talking about two topics we've spoken about before, but first, we want to thank our patrons, because they're the ones that voted for this episode, so thank you to our patrons.
Thank you, patrons. Well,
thanks a lot. That's nice.
So nice.
I have no personal connection to you.
Well, maybe you can answer this question along with everyone listening and watching. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify or anywhere else, head over to YouTube and get down in the comments of this episode and answer this question for us. Are you autistic? Do you have gender dysphoria? Or are you greedy? And have you gotten both?
Oh. Potentially.
So I'm sure you could probably guess what we're talking about this week. Our patrons voted in the topic of autism and gender dysphoria. So we're talking about the relationship between those two this week. But before we can actually get into the relationship between them, we need to understand what they are. So first off, Noah, what is autism?
I don't know. Something, your brain's a bit different. You're a bit different brain-wise.
Anyone else got anything to add to that?
I know what the like symptoms are.
I wouldn't be able to give you DSM-5, Corey. Yeah. What else you want?
I wouldn't be able to give you like a concise definition.
Can anyone give a concise definition?
Absolutely not.
It's a neurodevelopmental. Is it a disorder? Is it characterized as a disorder? A neurodevelopmental disorder characterized by different social understandings and other, I don't know, it's a mix of a bunch of different things.
Like a processing thing.
It's lots of things, yeah.
So like,
if you want to know a full explanation of what autism is, you can head to our episode that we did with Laura.
Are you gatekeeping the definition for views?
No.
If you want to know.
I'm sending people to a place where they can get more information. I'm about to give a much more concise definition. Okay. Thank you very much. So you could check out that episode. And actually, if you want the definition of autism, I'm not going to give it to you here, but I will give you a quick overview of what it is. So what the NHS says about autism is that they say autistic people might find it hard to communicate and interact with other people, find it hard to understand how other people think or feel, find things like bright lights or loud noises overwhelming, stressful, or uncomfortable, or get anxious or upset about unfamiliar situations and social events, take longer to understand information, or do or think the same things over and over. Essentially, when you talk about autism, there are a few features that are associated with it. There are sort of sensory processing sort of issues occasionally, often, and there are generally issues with sort of social interaction, in that basically autistic people's brains just work a little bit differently, and that causes those things. There you go.
Sounds about right.
Sounds about right. Cool. So we know what autism is, yeah? We got a decent grasp of what autism is.
Oh, comprehensive.
More or less.
Yeah. According to the NHS, yeah.
So roughly 1% to 2% of the population is estimated to have autism. Obviously, we can't be 100% absolutely sure, but 1% to 2% is roughly what we think. And that's based on large-scale studies. Obviously, that can be impacted by, you know, diagnosis and things like that. Autism can be underdiagnosed, particularly in young girls. That's something that happens often. But yeah, 1% to 2%. We'll just stick with that general number, okay? Moving on from autism to gender dysphoria. Does anyone here have any idea what gender dysphoria might be? Noah?
What? It's like a discomfort, a state of unease or discomfort based on your gender. Dysphoria is just discomfort, isn't it?
And yeah.
Gender is just gender.
Where can people go if they want to have a more in-depth
understanding? There's a really good gender dysphoria episode. If you go and watch that, we made that as well. So
oh, wow,
go and give that
it's
a view as well.
It's called The Science of Gender Dysphoria.
Was I in that?
You were in that, yeah.
Oh, right. I've done a lot. I've been in a lot of Sad Guys episodes.
I'm glad you managed to get, you know, the basics of gender dysphoria from sitting in that episode.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was until then.
So gender dysphoria, just from the NHS, is a term that describes a sense of unease that a person may have because of a mismatch between their biological sex and their gender identity. Does anyone want to hazard a guess at what biological sex means and what gender identity means?
Oh, good God.
Oh, Lord.
Come on. Step into the minefield. Go on, do it.
Okay, well, biological sex, I would say, is the manifestation of primary and secondary sex characteristics based upon usually your chromosomes, but sometimes you can have androgen insensitivity disorder, which means you can have a set of chromosomes and have a different appearance of sex.
So yeah, that's right. Androgen insensitivity syndrome is just one of many things that can make your chromosomes not necessarily match the appearance of your biological sex. So biological sex, yeah, it's all of those sex characteristics. So chromosomes, it's like facial hair, genitalia, gonads, so that would be sort of testes and ovaries. All of those things come together to make up your biological sex. As we have spoken about on this podcast many times before, there's actually a very specific video on this. Biological sex isn't as simple as you might think. It's not a very binary thing. You know what I mean? There are lots of different things that we use to measure it, and people will say, oh, it's down to chromosomes, it's down to this, it's down to that, it's down to gamete size. That is probably the best way to determine biological sex, is the size of the potential gametes that someone's body might be able to produce, because
it's more complicated than we thought.
It's too complicated.
Yeah. No, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. But even then, looking at gamete size, not everyone can produce gametes. Not everyone has the capacity to produce gametes. We've even found, I think, at least maybe one. I think one case study where someone had the tissue that was potentially capable of producing both kinds of gametes.
Wow,
big and small. That would be eggs and sperm. That's what I mean when I say gametes. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, biological sex, complicated, but you probably already know what it is. It's generally genitalia and chromosomes and that sort of thing. Yeah?
Yep.
We're all happy with that?
Yeah. Yep.
Very good. Now, what's gender identity?
Oh, no.
Well, this doesn't have a particularly good definition. Maybe it does, but like, I've always thought of it as like, in my brain's way of conceptualizing, you've got like your self. Your self is like a collection of sort of information about how you identify, and one of the sort of flags on that information database of me is like my gender, and that is sort of, and then it has all sorts of like societal implications, but and also has a certain level of correlation between sex, but that can also not be the case.
Yeah.
Basically, that's a big way of me saying, I don't know.
What the NHS says is that gender identity refers to our sense of who we are and how we see and describe ourselves, and that most people identify as male or female, or men and women, and those are the binary identities. So if we're talking about binary identities, we're talking about men and women or male and female, okay? And some people feel that their identity is different from their biological sex. Those people would be what?
Crazy.
Jesus, no, you can't say that. No, you can't say that.
I'm trans.
Okay, you're what?
No, I can say
I'm
that.
Trans.
Okay, transgender is the answer that we were looking for. So
you can say that for fun. It's allowed.
Just a treat.
A little bit of fun.
Imagine a new listener coming in, listening to this episode for the first time, being like, oh, wow, an episode of this podcast that I've just found about gender identity and autism. And suddenly...
Well, I answered crazy. The question, do you have both? And I said, potentially.
Oh, okay, very good. That's fine. So. Yeah, gender identity, back to the NHS and what they say. They say, for example, some people may have male genitals and facial hair, but do not identify as male or feel masculine, and vice versa. And some people don't even define themselves as having a binary identity at all. Those people would be non-binary. And you can be, there are different flavors of non-binary. There's like agender, gender diverse, non-conforming. There's gender fluid. There's so many different flavors of gender. And you can have anyone.
They're all
that's
tasty.
Fine. They're all good. That's fine. Yeah. Whatever. Choose whichever one you want. Or don't choose. I don't know.
Choose. Okay.
Whoa.
I think this is a choice.
Ooh.
You're
wow.
allowed to choose if you want.
You cannot choose your internal understanding and sense of gender, but you can absolutely choose the label that you use to describe your gender. Exactly. Because labels they're not real. They're made up. They're just words that we've made up, and they have meanings that we ascribe to them. They're not, you know, strict biological reality.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't exist. Okay. Are we all caught up on autism and gender dysphoria?
Absolutely.
And I want to say as well, another thing here that is going to be relevant when it comes to, you know, talking about autism and gender dysphoria is that gender dysphoria does not equal transgender. So there are some people that could have gender dysphoria that aren't transgender. And there are some people that are transgender that don't have gender dysphoria. Okay?
But how does being trans without gender dysphoria work?
Well, it's more about your sense of identity rather than, because dysphoria is like discomfort. And like,
right, so you can just have a different identity. But like,
yeah,
it doesn't
you're not
upset
about
me,
it. Yeah.
But it's still not who I am.
Yeah. Yeah,
like
yeah.
If I was, if someone plopped my brain into Rebecca's body, and I was like, I don't identify as this, but it's not. Yeah. It doesn't bother me too much. But
yeah. It's quite nice in here.
It's fine, but like, it's not me.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So according to a sex health study published in 2017, there's a prevalence ranging from 0.5% to 1.3% for self-reported transgender identity in children, adolescents, and adults. And according to a national survey of the United States, 1.4 million individuals identify as transgender. Okay, so those are the kind of numbers that we're working with. Yeah, so we've got somewhere between 0.5 to 1.3% of the population is trans generally, and about 1 to 2% of the population are autistic generally. But those aren't going to be hard numbers, because, you know, obviously underdiagnosis in autism could affect that, and it also is affected when it comes to being transgender. That's affected by the terms that people use for themselves, whether people are able to come out, whether people know that they're trans or not, whether people have been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. All of these things kind of come into this and make it really difficult to get an actual hard number, which is why you've probably seen an increase in people identifying as transgender over the past, you know, couple decades, because the internet has gotten bigger. People have gotten, you know, I guess more accepting towards people that are trans. And so it's easier to, you know, come out as trans. It's easier to say that you're a trans person. Mm. Now,
I was gonna say, it's also just because like more people know about it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I
yeah.
was telling people on the playground my name was Alex and that I was a boy, and I would put Play-Doh down my pants and pretend it was a willy when I was like 5. Like, if I knew what being trans was then, I would have easily just been like, oh yeah, yeah, that, makes, that sense. Makes sense.
And when you were 5, you didn't have any YouTubers conditioning you into being trans, right?
None of those rumors.
No.
And crucially, okay. They weren't yet putting things in the water that were turning the frogs gay. So that's mad.
These are the before times.
Yeah, I just want to quickly hop in and say that,
like a frog in
the
water.
Yeah, like hop in. Oh no! They're putting frogs in the water now. They're turning people gay.
Putting gay frogs in the clean water.
I just want to hop in and say, because these kinds of episodes attract a lot of people who would describe themselves as gender critical or TERFs, or, you know, they wouldn't describe themselves as transphobic. They describe themselves as people fighting for women's rights.
They describe themselves as people.
You describe yourself as whatever you want to describe yourself. But the fact is, if you've got these kinds of views, you're a transphobe or a TERF. And that's what you're going to be called. These kinds of views I'm talking about are the ones wherein they say the rise in the transgender population over the past few years is due to social contagion and conditioning and medical conspiracies, blah, 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 erosion of women's rights, because trans people are having the rights that they've always kind of half had without people really paying attention. Shut up. That's not the case. The numbers are rising because it is more acceptable and more people know about it.
Are there any studies that say it's contagious?
No.
Maybe.
Like,
I mean,
Tourette's. Like the ticks thing on TikTok.
Oh, oh, when
contagious.
Someone ticks. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
well, yeah, look, stupid. I mean, we've discussed that as well, like on this channel, the TikTok.
Oh, my God, I literally, I had the worst. I'm such an idiot sometimes. I walked up to, is it Evie?
Yeah.
Evie Meg? We did an episode of Sci Guys covering this like big thing on the news about how she was supposedly giving everyone Tourette's by recording herself.
Yeah.
And I walked, I met her, and I wanted to say hi because I really liked what she did. And I was like, oh, hey, I did a bunch of research on you because I did a Sci Guys thing, an episode of my podcast where we talked about all that news stuff. And I didn't clarify that in that I was like, and I'm on your side.
Yeah. Like,
but yeah, she was lovely. As soon as I clarified that I was on her side, she was very lovely.
But I'm glad you got
it. It's a very Luke interaction to have.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
We're missing
you.
Some crucial information.
That makes sense. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've
done
my
research. I was just trying to say hi.
No, I know.
Badly.
But I actually think that's really interesting, right? Like the Tourette's has had a similar sort of thing to what trans people have had, where you've got creators that just have Tourette's and are just making stuff because they want to make stuff, and they're being labeled as dangerous and, you know, affecting kids and convincing kids to have Tourette's, all of that sort of stuff. When they're just out there living their lives.
That's what the annoying thing about like being a YouTuber that talks about trans stuff is, because like when I make trans videos and I'm talking about my experience, it's to help like other trans people. Mm. I'm not trying to attract cis people to like transition them. I'm just like, hey, this is how I transitioned. This was easier for me than some people have it. But like, yeah, it's weird.
It is very weird. Let's move back on to autism and gender dysphoria, though, because I want to kind of get into why we're talking about this today. So why do you think we're talking about the relationship between autism and gender dysphoria?
Because a lot of trans people are autistic.
Or maybe a lot of autistic people are trans.
No, well, yeah, well, I think people with autism tend to have like a different view of the world or a different understanding of it. And that also tends to interfere with their understanding of their gender, because it's like an own self-identity kind of thing. Yeah, but they just have a different relationship with identity things, I guess.
So I want to look at some studies that actually look at this sort of higher prevalence of autism amongst trans people, or of transgenderness amongst autistic people.
You sound like a Tory MP in the House of Commons.
There's a lot of transgenderness going around.
So there have been like a fair few studies on this, and the kind of numbers that I've got are between 4% and 5.4% of autistic children potentially being transgender or gender diverse, compared to in this study 0.7% of non-autistic children. So that's like quite an increase, right?
Yeah,
from 0.7% to about 4 to 5.4%. And the biggest study that I found in this review that I looked at just under 300,000 kids, and they found that for gender dysphoria, there was a likelihood of a clinical diagnosis of 0.07% in autistic children and 0.01% in non-autistic children.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot.
It's a big difference, right?
Yeah, times.
And that's it. And bear in mind, right, that obviously looks a lot lower than the 0.7 and 4% numbers that we've spoken about in that last study. But this study was looking at gender dysphoria. And that's why I kind of wanted to talk about the difference between gender dysphoria and being trans at the top of this episode, because a lot of these studies use different sort of parameters for, you know, how they're actually looking at this. Right. You know, some of them are looking for autistic traits. Some of them are looking for autism diagnosis. Some of them are looking for self-described transgender or gender diverse identity. Some of them are just looking at whether someone has gender dysphoria. Some of them are looking at whether someone identifies as transgender. And there's lots of different ways of sort of quantifying these. So there's going to be lots of varying numbers. Mm-hmm. But across all of those numbers, one thing remains pretty clear, that there seems to be a higher percentage of sort of trans people that are autistic compared to the cisgender population.
Yeah.
Cool. And another study looked at both kids and teens and adults with gender dysphoria, and they found that at between about 4.8 to 26% of individuals who were at gender dysphoria clinics had an autism diagnosis based on like several different criteria.
A diagnosis?
Yeah. So
not even
4.8
just like
and 26. But then, yeah, not
symptom,
even
like traits of it.
Exactly. Whoa. But you got to think about it this way, right? There are lots of different reasons that that might be the case, because, you know, if someone is going to a gender clinic,
yeah,
it probably does mean that they're slightly more likely to have pursued, you know, medical help or advice for other issues in the past. Or they could have been told, like, you know, while speaking to a specialist, hey, have you considered this?
Yeah.
There are lots of reasons that someone with a diagnosis might be more likely to seek help at a clinic.
Diagnosis.
Yes.
Exactly, right? But that's not to say that there isn't an increase. I'm just saying this number going from 4.8 up to 26%.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
I find that interesting, because I feel like a lot of people would look at that study and be like, oh, they're just autistic. See, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, I personally don't care if the reason I'm trans is because of potential autism. Like, it doesn't matter what the reason is, because autism is not something you can change. It's not like an identity that you can just get rid of, and dysphoria isn't something you can get rid of either, unless you... There are ways to get rid of it by transitioning, but, like, I don't know. It's interesting that there are studies like that, and I've seen a lot of people comment, like, oh, it's because of autism on my videos, but it's just like, regardless of what it is, it doesn't really matter.
It's still there.
Yeah, it's still there.
I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that, I mean, what people don't really pay attention to is that autism or any sort of neurodivergence isn't just a thing that you have. It's to an extent something that is inextricable from who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. Not to say that, you know, You can't be like, you can't separate someone from autism, that they're only autism, you know, and that's all that they are. What I mean is that being neurodivergent affects pretty much every aspect of your life, you know, in that it affects your experiences growing up, which influences the kind of person that you become. So to say, oh, the autism is causing them to be this.
What autism is them. It's a part of who they are.
They're not like a non-neurodivergent person with a neurodivergent add-on.
It's not like a cold. It's not like you get symptoms and you take pills for it and you get rid of it.
I think a lot of the stuff about, like, especially with our attitude to transgender people and also with autistic and things like this, is that we've sort of, throughout history, we've sort of added these categories to our experiences. So we've like categorized, oh, well, the majority of people fit into this thing we call man, and the majority of people fit into this thing we call woman, and then we institutionalize those things. Mm-hmm. And then equally, oh, the majority of people fit into this thing we call neurotypical. All right, that's now the norm, and anything else is like got a software add-on, like a Sims expansion pack.
Well, people think of like autistic people as normal people, but with, you just take out the social, you take out the social interaction abilities, and that's an autistic person,
that's
right?
It's like saying you're something with three arms that's just had one of its arms taken away.
No, exactly, right? It's a weird way. I think what we often do is we think of the baseline person, and I don't know what the baseline person is according to society. It couldn't, it couldn't at all be a cisgendered white
man. Yeah, it's not us.
Oh, no. It's not us, definitely. Yeah, cisgendered, heterosexual, able-bodied, white man, right?
Six foot two. What is it? All the cities are built for this like imaginary 6 foot two man.
Hey, I don't mind that. That's cool. Okay. But the planes are definitely not built for that imaginary 6 foot two man.
Well, you've got everything else. You got all the doors, man.
I also find it interesting that like it's weird because like gender dysphoria doesn't necessarily make you trans, and having difficulties with social interaction doesn't necessarily make you autistic. And they're still just words that we've put a bunch of symptoms under.
I think the difficulty is as well, is that trans is a word that means very little. I mean, it's got a pretty specific definition, right?
Which is
transgender means that your gender identity is not the same as the one that you were assigned at birth, right?
Yeah.
Like it is as simple as that. If you have a gender identity that does not match, you know, the sex and gender that you're, the sex and therefore gender that you were assigned at birth, then you are trans. Very simple, straightforward, easy. But that encapsulates a lot of different kinds of people, right? Like, you know, it's quite similar to what I was talking about way back when, I think a couple years ago in our episode on the gay gene or lack thereof. Luke, do you remember my little analogy that you love so much?
Oh my God. Yeah. Corey says that being gay is a symptom, not a disease.
Exactly.
It's like having diarrhea.
Yes, because diarrhea isn't a disease. It can be caused by any, diarrhea can be caused by any number of things, right? So it's just a symptom. And to find the cause of that, you can look for the disease or the thing that's causing it. Like, you know, perhaps you ate too many raw shrews, Luke, and suddenly you've got diarrhea.
Oh,
or,
no.
I don't know, perhaps you've got IBS, Noah, and you've got diarrhea.
Like diarrhea gang!
But you can't look at someone that has diarrhea and say, I know exactly what's going on with them. All you can say
you're
is...
gay! That's what it is, you're gay.
Gay people do have IBS, as far as Twitter says. I don't know. My point is, apparently there's this whole thing about gays having IBS. I don't know.
I've heard this thing about like people with ADHD having IBS. There's a lot of people, apparently there's like a higher prevalence of people with like intestinal issues if they're neurodivergent.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
Which is insane. It's so insane.
My point is that when we say trans, we often think of that as just one thing. But if you've met more than one trans person in your life, you realize that trans people, surprisingly, and brace yourselves for this, are individuals.
Whoa,
not a monolith.
Well, we're all part of this trans machine.
Trans club, you know, getting kids to join, saying, hey, you catch them on the street corners on YouTube, and you're like, hey kids, hey little cis kids, you want to be trans?
Or some hormone blockers?
Come get some tea.
Okay.
I guess.
Yeah, so bear that in mind, that when we're talking about this, autism has a fairly clear sort of definition. in that there are diagnostic criteria that we work from, but obviously that's not perfect because people can be undiagnosed, people can be misdiagnosed,
yeah.
And it does come down to some extent to human interpretation based on the person that is giving the diagnosis. So autism is probably a little bit better characterized than being trans in this instance, but we just got to bear in mind that when we talk about these things, there could be different things that lead someone to being trans. And so, for example, let's say trans people that are autistic, there could be something with certain things that end up making you trans and autistic, right? That could be a case. But it's hard to speak about this sort of, definitively, because there are so many different, there are potentially so many different things that could cause someone to be transgender.
No, I was going to say, and it's also like, it's not like cancer where you can get a scan. They're like, yes, we can see the cancer.
We found it.
Yeah.
We like, found the transgenderism.
No, exactly. But it's like, right there. It's not like you go to an appointment and they're like, oh yeah, of course, this is easy. Like, it says it on the sheet. And the same with like autism, like, especially with like women. Apparently it's more common to be diagnosed as a woman with autism, as a woman with autism. Like, you're more likely to be diagnosed in your 20s if you're a woman. Right. Then like, because obviously like the model is based on like little boys with autism.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier to diagnose them. Whereas like, girls with autism will have a completely different experience because they were raised completely differently.
Well, yeah, I think we spoke about that in the autism episode, if you want to go and check that one out. There are differences in the presentation of autism. At least, you know, we can see differences in the presentation of autism between young girls and young boys. And obviously, that then means because we base literally pretty much every single kind of diagnosis, unless it's specific to, you know, women, we base them off of men, more specifically, white men. So it's when it comes to diagnosing certain things, like not just mental health conditions or neurodivergencies, when it comes to diagnosing a lot of things, a lot of times it's based off of, you know, the model of a white man, which is obviously going to make things slightly more difficult when you get to, you know, different groups of people that are slightly different to white men. But back to these sort of studies, there are a few studies showing increased chances, but I kind of want to talk about one in particular from 2020. It was run by the Cambridge Autism Research Center. It used data sets from 5 large-scale online survey-based data sets. Over 500,000 of those were from the Channel 4 documentary, Are You Autistic? So Channel 4, I'm not entirely sure what was going on with the Channel 4 thing, but Channel 4 apparently ran a documentary called Are You Autistic? There was a whole sort of survey involved in that. Here's just a quote from this article. It's called Elevated Rates of Autism, Other Neurodevelopmental and Psychiatric Diagnoses, and Autistic Traits in Transgender and Gender Diverse Individuals. And that's in Nature Communications. That is a real mouthful.
Jesus.
So the quote here is, transgender and gender diverse individuals were 3.03 to 6.36 times as likely to be autistic than were cisgender individuals after controlling for age and educational attainment. Second, transgender and gender diverse individuals scored significantly higher on self-report measures of autistic traits, systemizing and sensory sensitivity, and scored significantly lower on empathy traits compared to cisgender individuals. Third, in 2 data sets with available data, transgender and gender diverse individuals had elevated rates of multiple other neurodevelopmental and psychiatric conditions. Finally, exploratory analysis identified that transgender and gender diverse individuals were more likely to report that they suspected they had undiagnosed autism. So this study is actually really interesting. If you want to read it, absolutely go ahead, linked in the description. If you don't want to read through a whole study, they actually did an article on the study that kind of breaks it down in a more understandable format. And I've got that link down below as well. It's really, really good. I really enjoyed reading it. And they obviously they were using surveys. There's some, obviously, a few issues with doing online surveys and pulling your data from places like that, but the results seem pretty solid. It's a pretty good paper in my mind.
I find it interesting that there are higher rates of like autistic traits in trans people, because that could just mean like you're not very great at social interaction. Yeah. But like, if you're growing up in a world and you feel really uncomfortable with yourself and people talk to you as if you're a different person than you actually are, like, of course you're going to have social difficulties. Like, I wouldn't leave the house or go on the phone. Like, I wouldn't talk to anyone on the phone because I was just like, my voice is too high. They're going to think I'm a girl.
Yeah.
And that could be seen as like an autistic trait, like avoiding social interaction.
So yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of those things. I don't know if it was this study in particular, but at least one of the things that is linked down below talks about that. And I guess this study looked at like sort of lots of different lots of different ways of sort of ascertaining this. And the reason, one of the reasons that they looked at autistic traits and not just a diagnosis of autism is because some people might not be diagnosed. They also looked at whether people reported whether they felt like they had undiagnosed autism as well, because you want to get this from all angles. And it's, like I said, it's a good study. They also looked at other neurodivergencies, like ADHD. They also looked at things like bipolar and all that sort of stuff. And they found that there was, as it says here, these transgender and gender diverse individuals had elevated rates of multiple other neurodevelopmental and psychiatric conditions. So hard to talk today. But yeah, so they found that, you know, there was higher rates of neurodivergence and other psychiatric conditions like, you know, depression and anxiety and all that stuff. That makes sense if you're autistic or if you've got gender dysphoria or you're trans, you are probably more likely to experience those things just based on, at the very least, your upbringing and the difficulty of living in a world, you know, being trans or being autistic.
I feel like it's kind of difficult with this kind of thing because, like, so many of those things have, like, interlapping symptoms. And if you could take a person just as they are as a person, completely remove them from all their social experiences, just see them as a person and then diagnose them with BPT or autism or ADHD, that would be a lot easier. But because, like, if you have ADHD, you'll grow up in a world and you'll be put down a lot because you're too loud or you're too something, so you'd have difficulties with social situations there. But then also, like, if you're trans, you just... It's weird because, like, these are all just kind of words that we've put a list of symptoms underneath, and trying to figure out the specifics is difficult because, like, even then, like, I thought all my issues were caused by being trans. Then I transitioned. That was fine, but I still had issues. Then I thought they were caused by having ADHD. I'm medicated for ADHD, and there's still things that I think is, like, autism. So it's just, like, it's like ticking off all the boxes of just, like, where specifically does this come from? And I don't know if it's very easy for many people to actually, like, find those things.
It was interesting that you're saying that, because those are the kinds of stories that I've read about in a bunch of these papers that I've looked at. And it's interesting to have someone sit and be like, yes, also me too.
When you're talking about all these, because we've talked about in the past how, like, there's lots of mental health conditions that kind of overlap with each other, and it feels almost like we are on the edge of a breakthrough in our understanding, where, like, we're like, okay, all these things kind of overlap, and they kind of, like, these things, like, if you have this, it kind of looks like you might also have this, or you're likely to have this. It feels like there's, like, another layer underneath
that's
causing all of these separate things, or, like, a different model of our brains and our own psychiatry and psyches. That means that if we, because it's a very confusing landscape. Almost like when you have, like, a model of physics, and obviously you can't ever compare different sciences because they're operating at different levels. Yeah. But when you have a model in physics and you've got, like, well, this thing doesn't quite fit, and this thing and this thing kind of do the same thing, and this equation works up to this level, and this equation works up to this level, it's like, well, maybe there's something deeper that is causing both of those two things, and we're going to have a big breakthrough in our understanding and then figure out what the heck's going on.
I just think, like, a lot of it comes from trauma as well, because you can't separate that. But it's so weird, because it's like, it feels like we're trying to force people into these categories that they could actually fit into, but there's always going to be, what are those called, those little diagrams?
The Venn diagram.
It's like a Venn diagram.
I think, in defense of categories for a moment, and we all know that I'm what I think of categories. In defense of categories, they are incredibly useful. I think what we've spoken about a lot on the podcast is that categories are useful, but they're limited, you know? And the point at which the categories become problematic is when we ignore the limitations and just try and use them for everything, right? Yeah. So, for example, having the category of male and female, super bloody useful. I love that we're able to do that. I'm very glad that we have the categories male, female, and intersex. Incredibly useful. However, there are limitations to using those categories sometimes. And if we ignore those limitations, then we end up just harming people and honestly getting worse results, right? Like, it is absolutely useful to have the idea of autism, to have the idea of ADHD, to have the idea of depression and gender dysphoria and all of these things, because it means we can sort of send targeted help to sort of people that need it. But when we start to think of these as absolute, real, definite things that totally exist, it's not it's not quite as easy because brains are complicated and we don't understand brains yet. It's not quite as easy as, like you were saying, you can't go in for a gender dysphoria screening and just have them run a little scan on your brain and be like, oh, yeah. you got the dysphoria.
There it is.
You got it. You know, like an autism
big
screening.
Sad face on the MRI scan.
At the gender section of the brain.
And then when you call the person a boy, it smiles.
And that applies for all of them. Weirdly. Yeah.
They say there's like an autism center too. It's like, you have autism, it just lights up.
Yeah, like, I mean, people are complex, right? Like, and I mean, this kind of comes into it as well when we talk about sort of sexuality, right? Just to sort of highlight this will really sort of give you an idea of what I'm talking about. We talk about sexuality, right? There are different sexuality labels. You've got gay, you've got bi, you've got straight, you've got asexual, you've got a whole host of other ones, and I'm not going to list them all out now because it'll take far too long. I can't.
You can't.
It's an endless list. As soon as I finish the list, someone will come up with another one to describe themselves specifically. And that's fine, right? But two gay men are not the same as each other. They could be attracted. So, for example, one gay man could be attracted very, very strongly to masculine men, right? Like very masculine men. And another gay man could be attracted to very feminine men. Now, you could also have genital preferences as well. Mm. Imagine if, for example, if one of them had a preference for a different genitalia than the other. They're both still gay, and they both still very, very like neatly fall under the category we have of gay, which is you are a man who is attracted exclusively to other men. That's it. They're both gay, but they're both attracted to two completely different two different kinds of people, where if you saw them on the street, you'd be like, why are we grouping these two together?
Yeah.
In terms of sexuality, like, because, you know, sexuality to an extent can be based on aesthetics. So it's just, you know what I mean? Like, there are limitations to these sort of categories. And the response that people often have to that is, well, I'll just make another more specific category. You know, and that's where we start getting sort of micro labels and all that stuff. And that is great for, you know, understanding yourself and to some extent, getting people to have a very, very specific understanding of what you're trying to of sort of your interpretation of, you know, your identity. It's great for that, but ultimately at some point, you know, a micro label gets down to the point of just sitting down and explaining to someone exactly very specifically who you're, you know, what I mean?
I think a lot of the trouble as well is that because so much of our educational system is based upon categories, and we're not, as Corey and I go on about a lot, we're not ever taught that we're being taught categories that aren't objectively true.
Yeah.
You might be taught that at university if you know, even then. Okay. Well, anyway. My point is that your brain, so much of your brain is then being sort of organized by categories, and you start thinking of yourself in terms of categories.
Yeah.
And then when you do something or feel something that doesn't sort of link up with your concept of yourself, because your concept of yourself is based upon limited categories, you feel this weird experience of like, oh, but that's not very me.
Yeah.
That's not what I do, despite the fact that that is exactly what you're doing. like you can have feelings that aren't you because they don't match up to the sort of data boxes you have in your brain. And I just wish that someone had taught me at a much earlier age than me having to figure it out for myself, that these things aren't objectively real. They're just very helpful.
Yeah,
because I built up an idea of myself that was based on categories.
Yeah, you
and
like
then
fit
I was
yourself
like,
into
just
it.
Had all these feelings. I was like, I don't understand. That's not me. I don't. Yeah. Who am I anymore? Oh no.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, you mentioned earlier, Luke, that you can't compare between the sciences because they operate on different levels, and I want to touch on that again because I find it really interesting. Because science categories are something that we have. Physics is different from chemistry, is different from biology. But not really.
Not
like,
really.
Physics kind of becomes chemistry when matter and the specific properties of that matter become important. But ultimately, chemistry is just physics, isn't it? It's just a lot of physics. And biology is just a lot of chemistry. Like, ultimately, not what really separates studying biology from studying chemistry? That's an actual question. What separates the study of those two?
Different color exercise books.
That's true.
Well,
other than the exercise books.
Biology is a subsection. Is a subsection of large chemistry where it's to do with life and like organic matter and things like that. Whereas it's not to do with like, you don't do the study of, because if biology is big chemistry, biology doesn't study large quantities of hydrochloric acid.
Yeah.
Like really big quantity. It doesn't do that. So it's a specific part about organic life.
When I say big chemistry, what I mean is not just, you know, well, I don't mean lots. Yeah. I don't mean like lots of a chemical. Yeah. I mean lots of chemistry, lots of different chemical reactions.
Yes, of course.
Because life is just...
That's what I mean, though, is that if chemistry is big physics, mm-hmm. and biology is big chemistry, but chemistry being big physics, chemistry doesn't do anything to do with, like, gravitation, for example, or doesn't do...
Not necessarily.
Yeah, not necessarily. And then physics, biology doesn't do anything to do with some parts of chemistry.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there is, like, strong overlap. So I did biotechnology, which is kind of biochemistry mixed with biochemical engineering, which is biology mixed with chemistry mixed with physics.
Yeah.
I was studying sort of big vats that you make, that you sort of grow bacteria in, let's say, right? You grow microorganisms in. Mm-hmm. And to study that, I need to study impellers, which are basically mixing systems. And to do that, I need to understand shear forces, which is just specifically physics. I don't just need to understand the forces in a liquid. I need to understand how the forces in a liquid impact a biological, like a microorganism. And I also need to understand the chemistry of those microorganisms, because that's incredibly important to making a product. If I want to make a product, you know, like, let's say insulin or whatever, if I want to make whatever chemical, right? Not only do I need to understand the chemical properties of that product so that I can make sure that I can, you know, remove it, separate it from, you know, the rest of the stuff at the end, I also need to understand the biological properties of the thing that I'm using to make it so that I can make this microorganism produce whatever product I want, whilst also paying attention to all the physics to make sure I don't kill the microorganism. My point is that, like, any sort of, when we sort of separate out the sciences, that is, those categories, they make sense and it's useful, but there's so much overlap, and we tend to think of things in a very, like, sort of, this is biology, this is chemistry, this is physics. But when you study certain things, you've got to bring them all together. Do you know what I mean? Like, we separate out these disciplines, but ultimately we're all kind of studying the same sort of thing, you know?
You can join us next week for our new episode, The Physics of Being Transgender.
But yeah, what I mean is, right, like, you know, chemistry is just like physics. It's a lot of different kinds of physics, right? You would say that quantum mechanics, like quantum physics, like when you break down an atom, when you get smaller than an atom, you start getting into physics, right? But there's some overlap is all I'm saying.
Yeah. There's some quantum theory in flipping neuroscience now.
Oh, what? Really?
There's this theory that consciousness comes from quantum microtubules or something. Ooh. Like, it's just so complicated. I don't know if neurosurgeons or neuroscientists would be studying that. I don't know. But that is, like, you know, the study of consciousness is to do with, like, part of it is to do with quantum effects, which you'd think would be like a psychology, philosophy, and neuroscience thing, but it's now a quantum science, physics thing.
Maybe we could look into that for a future episode then. Yeah, I mean, getting back into the gender dysphoria and autism kind of relationship there, I want to talk a little bit about why there appears to be an increased sort of prevalence of autism amongst transgender people, or vice versa. So we don't know why. I want to put that out there first. We do not know why. I couldn't find an answer. I'm sure that the reason that some of the patrons voted this in was because they wanted to know why we see this. And I said, we don't know. We don't know. Okay, we don't know this. But
we don't even know how antidepressants work.
They're prescribed to millions.
Can you explain that further so you don't scare people off of antidepressants, please?
Well, we know that antidepressants work,
yeah.
But we don't know perfectly, like, the method of action as to how they work, or how We know some things, and we know that they work, but we don't know exactly how they work. Yeah, I mean, there's not really more to it than that. Don't be scared. It's okay. Antidepressants have gone through lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of trials, but we haven't got a clue how they work. But, I mean, is that so scary?
No, I don't find it scary. I find it interesting, if anything. You know, the fact that we use these things and we're like, I'm not totally sure what's going on here, but we do know that it gets results, right?
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of like, think of it this way, I suppose. People didn't know what yeast was when they made bread or beer for a long time.
But they still got drunk.
They just knew that if they left out their grapes for a bit, they would get incredibly better.
Fun time.
You know? Yeah. These grapes are more fun somehow. I don't know what it is.
I feel like there was a period of time in which being alive on the earth just felt like Minecraft.
Yeah.
Like, you just, like, put a material down and you stand there and then eventually it turns into a different thing, and you go, great.
Yeah. And also, everyone was doing magic mushrooms.
Yeah.
Like, they must have been like...
But actually, though, imagine foraging, right? Like, oh, cool, an awesome mushroom, and then you have some, and you're like,
tasty.
Whoa.
I'm talking to God.
But then, you know, you could leave your milk inside of, you know, an animal skin, and then suddenly you come back, and you've got one of the best things known to man, just a cheese. You get addicted to it, you know? You're like, ah, this is amazing. Wow. I love this.
Cheese is good.
Cheese is good,
cheese
right?
Cheese is good.
Cheese tastes good. You're right, Luke. I feel like at some point in human history, just living on the planet would
be awesome.
Because you don't understand how anything works. You're just like, this stuff is great.
I wouldn't be worrying about an autism diagnosis.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, cool stuff is happening.
I'm just like, oh, that's just Noah. He just does weird things sometimes.
We just let him be.
I sometimes think about, people say, oh yeah, ADHD makes you a good sort of hunter-gatherer. You know, like it's people with ADHD are made for this sort of thing or that sort of thing.
Because they take risks.
Well, yeah.
They put themselves in danger, and sometimes that benefits the group.
And that actually reminds me of Percy Jackson. I think I mentioned this in a previous episode. In the Percy Jackson series.
I have the same birthday as him, sorry.
Oh, that's very good. All of the, I'm happy for you. All of the demigods have Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, the Olympians, all of that. It's about demigods or whatever in modern day Earth. All of the people that are demigods have ADHD, or they appear to have ADHD because they're battle ready. They've got battle reflexes. I find all that stuff interesting, because if you actually put someone with ADHD in a hunter-gatherer situation, I don't think you're going to have them be much, much better than everyone else. You're going to have them losing their basket.
Oh, I lost my berries. Like, oh, no. Again.
Oh, Noah, where's your spear?
You're like, I put it down and then it was gone.
Or like, you know, you get your kill, you've got it, and you come back to the tribe and you're like, guys, look at this. Look at how bloody my spear is. I totally killed this massive mammoth. It's so awesome. I can't wait to eat it. And they're like, Where's the mammoth? And you're like,
show it to
I forgot to bring it. You know, like, we focus a lot on the potential positive traits of something without thinking about how it actually affects everything.
Yeah, it's also interesting because it's just like, when you diagnose someone with ADHD or autism, you put them into these categories, whereas like, you could just be, we're all just people, and some of us have certain difficulties and all that kind of stuff. I don't know where I was going with that.
Feels like a reaction to the like we were talking earlier about the reaction to, there's a normal,
and then there's
non-normal, and that's all these people who have all these things going on. And it feels like a reaction to that of going, well, let's try and figure out why that might have been a beneficial evolutionary trait in the past. And that's a very lovely thing to do, and it's a way of sort of going, oh, this actually might be a good thing either in the past or now. But also, even if you have a theory as to why ADHD might have been beneficial, and then turns out that theory was wrong, it doesn't mean you then go back to going, oh, these people are weird, we should just kill them.
Yeah, I think that, and interestingly, I don't think all of these things are necessarily negative, right? Like ADHD, it's, I think, exacerbated by the fact that you grow up in a world where you're treated poorly for having ADHD, and you become an adult in a world where it's really difficult to have a 9-to-5 job or, you know, do any of these things and have ADHD. You know what I mean? Like, or it's difficult to grow up in a world being autistic, and then, you know, like, you know, with all the difficulties that entails, and then, you know, become an adult carrying all of that trauma with you and still being autistic in a world where it's nothing is kind of made with you in mind at all. Because it's very easy to accommodate for all of these things, like, relatively speaking, but we just tend not to.
It's also kind of interesting. I saw a discussion about this recently where, like, a potential symptom of ADHD is, like, rejection-sensitive dysphoria, where people with ADHD are more, like, sensitive to, like, rejection. And I saw, like, this massive thread about it, and people were just like, yeah, so maybe it's not a symptom of ADHD. Maybe it's just a symptom of how the world treats people with ADHD. And, of course, if you've been taught that, like, If you've been rejected your whole life or put down your whole life because of your symptoms, then that is something that you'd carry into adulthood, where you can't deal with rejection as well because it's traumatic for you.
Well, over the past couple of weeks, we spoke about the obesity paradox, actually. And so you probably could check out that episode. It was a good one. And we mentioned that on the NHS website, one of the sort of problems that you deal with if you've got obesity, it points out, is that you could have low self-esteem or trouble, you know, maintaining relationships with other people, or depression and stuff. And I'm like, that's not That doesn't have anything to do with having more fat on your body.
No.
That's got everything to do with living in a society where having more fat on your body makes people be mean to you.
Yeah, yeah, but it's also like different cultures being bigger is seen as a good thing. Like you're seen to be more healthy and like happy Buddha.
Well, our culture as well in Victorian times.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Like Henry Tudor, like all of them were like, they were blacking out their teeth because they wanted to look rich, and they were piling on the pounds because it was seen as like, that was like the norm. And then, yeah, it's just interesting.
It's really interesting how we struggle to delineate certain aspects of things. So like with autism, for example, we think of autistic people as being one particular way, but that could actually be an influence of just being around people that are mean to them all the time, you know, that sort of thing. But back to autism and gender dysphoria, why do you think there's this connection between them? Why do you think there's this increased sort of prevalence? Bear in mind, we don't know. We have some hypotheses, but that's all they are. We don't have any evidence to say this is exactly why.
I think because autistic people see the world very differently, a lot of the time they don't feel the need to fit in these very rigid categories, as in like the gender binary. Like, I know that a lot of, I don't know, I just think because like autistic people's brains work differently, they don't see the world the same, and why would they see their gender the same or their identity the same or even the concept of gender the same as people that aren't autistic?
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of that kind of corroborates with what I found in papers. That's what, yeah, well done, you're as smart as a scientist. No, that was one of the things that came to mind for me as well. And the papers that I've read are saying, you know, things like, well, you know, autistic people tend to sort of break social norms in some cases. And they, obviously autistic people aren't a monolith. Some autistic people are very, like, you know, in with rules and want to follow the rules of social norms. But others are already breaking the rules of social norms just kind of by virtue of being autistic. And so, if you're in for a penny, in for a pound, you know.
Yeah, we've had all of our categories, or a significant portion of our categories, are set up for like neurotypical people. Yeah. And so obviously, by definition, if you are not neurotypical, then some of those categories are not going to fit you, and you're going to find that very obvious. And then you're going to point it out.
Yeah.
It's also maybe because, like, autistic people, like, they've been shunned by society and treated bad by society, so maybe they don't feel the desire to fit in with the norm anyway.
And do you know what? Because I know people are going to misinterpret what we're saying, so I just need to clarify this very, very specifically. We are not saying that being autistic means that you're going to choose to then break boundaries in your gender, in that, like, you know, if you've got let's take the view of a TERF, for example, a trans exclusionary radical feminist, or as the internet has somehow managed to deem it, just a transphobic woman, but whatever, let's take that sort of view. Now, if you view trans men as lost young girls, you know, brought into the transgender craze by awful people like this person right next to me, if you view trans men as that, then seeing that there's a lot of autistic, trans men, you'd think, well, hold on, doesn't that mean that, like, them being autistic, they're being tricked, they're being confused? So when we're saying, you know, autistic people might be more likely to break social norms, that's what we're saying is they've already got the trans thing going on, right? They're already predisposed to being trans. They might just be more likely to do something about it or identify as trans based on those feelings. Whereas, this is something I spoke about in a video that's actually on my main channel. You could check that out if you'd like, not Corey. I spoke about how gender is a really difficult and interesting thing, in that with the categories that we've got, we kind of look at man as meaning one thing and woman as meaning one thing. But ultimately, my idea of man could be different from your idea of man. Right? Like, so when I say I'm a man, that could mean in my head these list of things. And when Luke says I'm a man, it could mean in his head these list of things. And that list of things could be almost entirely different, right? And the difference between, you know, like, you know, let's say you've got two people that have basically the exact same list of things that they say, like, sort of, that sort of comes into their understanding of their gender. They're like, this is what makes me my gender. And someone else is like, these things also make me my gender. They're the same, but they have two different genders. You know, one person like identifies as a cis man and the other person identifies as non-binary, because identifying as trans or non-binary isn't just a one-to-one of your experience, like, you know, of like whatever internal objective gender you've got. It's not an objective thing. It's viewed through, it necessarily has to go through this subjective lens of your own interpretation and experience. So a trans autistic person could potentially have the same internal sense of gender as someone who is cisgendered and not autistic. It's just that the trans person is more comfortable, the trans autistic person is more comfortable to break those social norms and identify as transgender based on that internal understanding of their own gender. Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
You know what we're advertising this week?
The concept of asking us to do things.
That's so true. We are now telling you that you could go to our Patreon and submit and vote on episode topics. So if you're ever listening to SciGuys and thinking, man, I wish I could tell these guys what to talk about.
Mm, I wish I could engage in the democratic process.
I love
among a small group of people who pay to be involved.
Head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys, where literally every single patron can vote every single month on a SciGuys topic. Do it now. There's also another more, I guess, scientific one. Prenatal sex hormones. What do you think? What do you think I'm going to get into here when I talk about prenatal sex hormones?
There is a theory that people are trans because they were... they experienced a lot of a specific hormone in the womb. People think that if you experience, if you come into contact with a lot of estrogen as a biological boy, because, well, biological baby boy.
Biological
embryo man boy child.
Sorry, I'm not a biological baby. I just identify as I'm baby.
Yeah, there's a theory that, like, If you experience high levels of testosterone or estrogen in the womb or whatever, that may change your gender identity.
Well, so prenatal sex hormones actually have, there's some evidence that they play a role in autism and gender role behavior, but that doesn't mean they necessarily contribute to gender identity. We're still not sure on that one. No, like this
you can't say that's so silly. Gender role behavior. Gender roles are entirely made up by the society.
I know,
in.
But like when you what I'm talking about here is not more estrogen makes you girl, but obviously the sort of environment of the womb and the sort of reception of the receptiveness of the fetus to that environment can impact the development of the fetus. So again, this wouldn't necessarily say every single transgender person is transgender because of prenatal sex hormones or that every autistic person is autistic because of that. They're just saying that, hey, look, this is a sort of precursor that we've noticed that could sort of lead to these things. Maybe there's something there. And bear in mind, that's where, you know, you bring back in what I was saying before about, you know, being gay being a symptom and not a disease, in that there are many things that you could that could lead to someone being trans or autistic, and this could be just one particular pathway that is somewhat linked. It's an idea that's an area for further study, really, but this stuff is so complex because it's very hard to pin down in a way that, you know, I mean, we don't have a way of delineating, you know, let's say there are multiple routes to having gender dysphoria. It's really hard to delineate which route someone has taken, you know what I mean? Just based on the endpoint of you've been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. In the same sense that if you've got like five people that have been diagnosed with depression, you have no idea what led any of those five to being depressed. One of them could be depressed because of trauma. One of them could be depressed, you know, like because of a chemical imbalance. There could be any number of different reasons, you know?
Do you also think there could just be, like, I just think some people are just trans. It's interesting because I'm just like, there could be causes, but maybe that's just how their brain works. Like, maybe that's just how they feel.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that's kind of brought up is that, you know, what you were mentioning earlier about a lot of autistic traits.
What do you mean by that?
As in, like, necessarily have to be a cause. It doesn't have to be...
But there will ultimately be a cause. If someone is just trans, then, as in there's no prenatal hormone or there's no societal reason, then it's genetic. Yeah. Or then that's the cause.
I guess.
But there'll ultimately be a cause.
I don't think of genetics as a cause, but obviously it is.
Well,
yeah.
If you eliminate all the rest of them, then
yeah.
I imagine genetics would be the cause.
Yeah.
Is there any other things? If it wasn't societal, it wasn't prenatal, it wasn't experiences in the womb, it wasn't being raised and experiences or trauma or anything like that.
Yeah, that's pretty much everything, isn't it?
And then genetics.
Yeah.
Or a soul. A trans soul.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Like, maybe it's just like a...
You're a man soul.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about the cause of something, I think what we should point out right now, this is a great point to talk about this, is that we tend to only talk about causes when it's a deviation from the norm.
And when it's something you're trying to fix.
Right. So, for example, what causes neurotypicality, right?
Yeah.
Like, what causes that?
A certain amount of genetics, a certain amount of untraumatic childhood.
Exactly. But we don't, that's the thing, we don't We don't talk about it in that sense. We don't say, oh, well, what causes people to be straight? You know, we don't ask that question. And I think it's important to pay attention to the language that we use surrounding sort of these things. Like we're looking when we were speaking about, you know, the gay gene a couple years ago in that episode with Rowan Ellis. Watch that. This is a really good episode for calling back.
so many plugs.
I know, right? When we were talking about the gay gene, one of the questions that kind of comes up is, why are we looking for a cause for being gay? Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, we view it as, there are certain things that we sort of view as needing to find a cause for. And I think that can be sort of an issue, having that sort of mindset of like, what causes this thing? In particular, because you kind of then get stuck on the idea that there's one thing that makes this one, that has this one outcome.
I don't totally agree. I think there's a lot of analysis going on of like, what causes us to have a nuclear family? What causes us to be monogamous? What, there's a lot of talk about that kind of stuff, which is the norm.
More so
We've
now.
We've done episodes about that.
Sure, yeah. More so now, right? Yeah. But that's not necessarily, that you can't say that that's the overall sort of viewpoint,
the history
history as well, and the overall sort of way that we operate, right? We're not looking for a straight gene, for example, right?
Well, I feel like not looking for a straight gene is maybe not a particularly good example, because there ultimately have to be, in our specific genetics, there have to be some females and some males who have sex in order for there to be people.
And they can be bisexual.
Yeah, of course.
So
exclusive heterosexuality gene?
Exclusive heterosexuality gene.
Yeah, sure.
Why are we not looking for that?
Perfectly interesting thing.
No, it would be a perfectly interesting thing. I'm not saying that we can't look for the reasons that something can come about. I'm not saying that we can't look for a cause, but what I'm saying is that when people often say, let's look for the cause of this, there's more to it than that. I'm not saying that we don't ever invest. I'm not saying that we never investigate, you know, the sort of how things happen. Like, obviously we've looked at like what causes monogamy, blah blah blah. But my point is more that when we talk about finding the cause for something, almost necessarily we're imagining something else as being a baseline.
Yeah.
And where we place that baseline is important, and we tend to ignore that. I'm not saying that we don't look at certain things. I'm just saying that the way that we talk and think about the things that we do is something that we should be doing.
Yeah, I think that to a certain extent comes from the fact that it's quite, even though it's potentially a bad thought process to have, there's a real big impetus, especially for parents, to look at the world and go, okay, the world is unjust in some ways. The world is unjust towards people like this. The world's unjust to people like this. I'm going to have a child and I want my child's life to be as easy as it can be. Mm-hmm. Even though if my child turned out to be like, if X child turned out to be gay or X child turned out to be autistic, you know, you would love them, but you also know that life is going to be harder for those people. And we can make as many efforts as we like to try and make that not harder and to talk about that and put systems in place to make it not harder. But I think a lot of people are looking out are just wanting their child to have the easiest, best life. Not best life, but like easiest life possible with the fewest complications. And so they're naturally going to look for, well, what causes these things that make life harder, even though we can put things in place to make it not harder.
Yeah, I was going to say, but there's also things of like, there are benefits of having ADHD. There are benefits of having autism. And it's like, obviously, a lot of the time, there are bad points to it. But I think a big thing is that people see, I had this talk with my therapist about it, because I mentioned that I thought I was autistic in my last therapy session. He was like, well, do you see it as like something wrong with you? Or something negative? And I'm like, not necessarily, because it's probably shaped some of the behaviors that I experienced that benefited me in some way. So I think it's interesting. Like, I understand the point of like, if you're autistic, you're probably more likely to have a difficult childhood and upbringing. But there's also the kind of thing where it's just like, maybe it's just not something wrong. It's just something different.
Yeah, and I absolutely don't ascribe to this thought process, by the way.
No, I know.
I am a child who fully, like, everyone was trying to get me to be normal, and I was like, that's not happening. There's no way. And I think I turned out all right. You've turned out great as well.
But you
like,
wouldn't be doing the stuff you do if you were normal.
Sure,
you wouldn't be as good at it if you were normal. Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
I don't think you'd be physically capable of doing any
all
of
I mean is I think there are a lot of people who just want their child to not bump into the sides too much and just have a, like,
But then this is exactly what I'm trying to point out here, right? Because the way that you've said that is really interesting, because you said that people are looking for what causes these things that make life more difficult. You've not said what causes the things that makes life easier, right? People don't look for causes straightness.
Yes.
They look for what causes, because what I'm saying is that when you say what causes X, you're placing the sort of
the assumption is that if you don't hit those causes, then you'll be the norm.
Yeah, you'll be the norm, right? And for example,
and it's a bad assumption.
You know, for all we know, right? And like, okay, put it this way, right? Based on some of the studies that we've done with like arousal in cisgender women, right?
Yeah.
We've seen the arousal in cisgender women appear like they have a bisexual arousal pattern. I'm not going to go too deep into what that means. That doesn't mean
there's
all...
a whole actual episode on that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Science of transgender sexuality, I think, is probably it.
Very interesting.
So we look at that, and we can look at other things like, you know, homosexuality in prisons, or you know, an increasing number of people identifying as LGBT. With like, you know, as society becomes more accepting of these things, we could look in the past where there wasn't quite the same understanding of straight, gay, bisexual. You know, it was either more fluid, or there were different sort of conceptions of it. Like, you know, for example, in I think ancient Rome, it wasn't a case of being necessarily gay. You were young and you were basically a bottom.
And then as you
became older, you were a man and you were a top. And that was how that identity worked. So the idea that we've got of being like, you know, gay isn't the same as it used to be. The idea that we have of being like lesbian, I was talking to someone about this the other day, where like, you know, we have issues with, you know, younger people not wanting to identify as lesbian, or people have issues with trans men identifying as lesbians, or people identifying as lesbians and using pronouns that aren't she, her. But lesbianism for a long time, and being gay for a long time, wasn't just who you wanted to have sex with. It was the culture surrounding it.
Yeah, like a lot of bisexual women would like... we're called gay.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's so many different understandings of all these words, right? And my point here, and I'm getting to it, my point here is, right, that we could conceive that, for example, bisexuality, like, you know, the concept of bisexuality, of being capable of being attracted to men and women, or males and females, or however you want to describe it, right? We could take the idea that that is the norm, and any variation upon that is abnormal, right? Or not abnormal, but a deviation from the norm. But we don't view it that way at all, because we have a very strict society wherein heterosexual is the norm, and you must be like I cannot tell you the number of supposedly straight men that I've spoken to who have said, "Oh yeah, to be honest, I think I might like, you know, be into guys a bit, but I'm into girls, so I'll stick with that."
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it'll be interesting, like, what if the norm was to have this level of trans people and this many trans people, and maybe the fact that there are so few is because so few people come out. Like, it's the norm is only the norm because we say it is, and the society that we're living in is enforcing a specific type of norm, and I think that's like a difficult thing to get away from.
I mean, my only point here is that we sometimes need to, I think, pull ourselves out of the, like, you know, the idea of what we see as the norm. And when we talk about, you know, what causes this deviation, we're inherently then saying that it's some kind of deviation, usually, you know. And it's just something to be aware of.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So we kind of, I think, really covered the idea that autistic people are less likely to conform to social norms, and then so will be more likely to identify outside of the stereotypical gender, sex, binary, and therefore, you know, identify as transgender, or potentially have gender dysphoria due to that that sort of mismatch there. Now, I do have a quote here from a paper. It says, "We identified some aspects of gender dysphoria which interacted with autism. Autism was described as having a positive effect on the understanding of gender for some individuals, with being autistic facilitating awareness of gender identity. This is consistent with ideas of autistic people being resistant to social conditioning regarding gender and gender defiance in autistic people."
Gender defiance.
I know, right?
I will not conform.
And we've spoken about the prenatal sex hormones and how that could have an impact. And also, interestingly, I found a study that interviewed 16 clinicians, 16 people from gender clinics, you know, like sort of doctors working there. I'm pretty sure they were doctors. Yeah, clinicians working at gender clinics. They interviewed them about autism and gender dysphoria. And again, really interestingly, the researchers received advice on, you know, the design of the study and the actual questions. They received advice from 6 autistic people, which is great. So a lot of the studies that you'll find linked below, I mean, pretty much all of them, are actually like really, really solid in terms of being trans positive. And this is not me, by the way, looking specifically for trans positive studies. I have just, those are just the ones that I've come across. And those are the ones that, you know, are sort of the most recommended and all of that sort of thing. Like, it's pretty cool that, you know, these studies are being done by people who are not trying to say, you know, that really awful, like, ableist and transphobic stuff that, You know, having autism and being trans means that you've been tricked because of your autism making you more gullible or whatever it is that trans folks are saying nowadays. But I do want to read out some quotes that I've got from these sort of clinicians, because they're really, really interesting. Participant A5 emphasized the way in which they conceptualize being autistic and experiencing gender dysphoria as related but distinct. You know how a rope is made of separate strands closely wound around each other? If you stand back at a distance, it looks like one thing, but on closer examination, the two things are distinct. It's just that they wind around each other a lot, so you can think of them as working in unison or being a problem in unison, right? So, I mean, it's an interesting way of thinking about it, of like, well, they're two distinct things, but they are definitely related. Mm. And the paper goes on. Most clinicians noted that specific features of autism, including detail focus, concrete thinking, and a need for certainty and control, could all increase gender dysphoria. These factors could also cause difficulties when undertaking a gender transition. Some clinicians described how they felt that different thinking styles in autism could contribute to seeing oneself as transgender. I guess maybe if you've got a more black and white concrete way of thinking about this stuff, then it may be easier to reach a conclusion about being transgender, you know. Whereas someone who's neurotypical might be able to consider things in a more complex way or a more nuanced way, which is a bit of a weird way of putting it, right? But then they go on to give a quote from someone else who says, I would say that maybe I've met more autistic people who have maybe done a bit more systematic questioning potentially of their gender. Maybe might describe the process more of like figuring things out and working through different options, and maybe might be quite reflective about different parts of things and why they feel the way that they do. So what these two very different quotes are saying are different things, but they kind of both kind of can come together and demonstrate ways that autistic people could be more likely to have gender dysphoria or be transgender. Obviously, autistic people aren't a monolith, so like these are two very distinct ways of arriving at this, but they both are, you know, something that you could perceive an autistic person sort of going through. For example, the first one, if you got sort of more black and white thinking, you could potentially have less trouble trying to reconcile like sort of these feelings of like looking for like a really nuanced sort of perception of your gender, like what is this, am I that, like maybe like how can I be the gender that I've been assigned at birth, blah blah blah, and just be like, oh well, I don't feel this way, so I must be this. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, someone that's not autistic might not be able to just have that very like.
That sounds a lot better.
That's yeah, right.
That's a lot less stressful,
right? Yeah. But then the alternative is that obviously, you know, that sort of introspection and working through it very systematically, which is another sort of trait that can be seen in autistic people. You can understand how that could lead someone to arrive at being more
like a flowchart.
Yeah, exactly. And so instead of like, you know, being someone that's holistic, so non-autistic, and being like, ah, guys, all of these things that I feel, what is going on? Ah, I don't know. If like the sort of hypothetical autistic person in this scenario is just working through it systematically, which again is a trait found in autistic people, and then arriving at a conclusion, being like, oh, I am transgender, that's what it is, you know, whilst this hypothetical non-autistic person is still sitting there like looking at all the pieces being like, what
they might have got to the conclusion that they're transgender, but then they're still thinking it over and worrying about it and going back and forward and like all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. And so the kind of overall thing that I find from reading all of these papers, and you know, you're probably sitting here thinking there's not much science in this episode, it's just you lot talking and going on different. Yeah, but there's not a huge amount of studies on this. And what I have found from these papers is mostly what we're talking about, right? Like the idea that you know, there's some ideas there that like you've brought up, that gender dysphoria could present itself similar to autism in some cases, just because, you know, there's the difficulty in sort of social interaction and whatnot. Because okay, think about it this way. If you're cisgender, right, and you're sitting listening to this, you're sitting watching this, and you're trying to imagine what it's like to be trans, I assume you are probably trying to imagine what it would be like to be a trans person of the sort of opposite gender or another gender to what you are, right? So if you're a man, you're probably sitting there thinking, what if I was a trans woman? Nah. Don't think about it that way. Think about trying to interact with people, you know, if like you had the body that you did not want to have. It would be difficult, I could imagine, right? Is it tough?
No, I was like, why are you looking at me?
you forget, buddy.
Well, yeah, no, I was like, I'm not the cis person that's imagining myself going, autism.
Yeah, so, you know, you could see how that could present similarly to autism in some cases. Like, what I'm saying here is that there are all of these different sort of hypotheses, and I can't sit here and tell you it is this one, because we just don't know what it is. There's also something else I read, which was really, really interesting. I kind of want to talk a little bit about why we need to take autism into account with treating sort of transgender people and vice versa, obviously, right? You want to look at people intersectionally. So you want to make sure that, you know, obviously treating someone that is autistic might be different from treating someone that isn't autistic because there are different needs that people have. I mean, every individual person has different needs, but obviously the categories that we make up kind of have a generalized set of needs that come along with them, right? So I want to read this quote from The Lived Experience of Gender Dysphoria in Autistic Adults, an Interpretive Phenomenological Analysis from 2021. Now, it says, there were also descriptions of increased challenges at the intersection of autism and transgender identity, such as distress due to competing needs for routine versus undergoing a gender transition. Autistic people often have a preference for certainty, and in this study, some participants were distressed when they were uncertain about their identity. This fits with previous research, which found confusion was a part of the life experience of gender dysphoria in the general transgender population. Finally, sensory sensitivities, characteristic of autism, contributed to increased gender dysphoria. For example, trans men struggled with the sensory aspect of having periods alongside the feeling that their bodies did not fit their gender identities, right? And so this is one scenario wherein you could see gender identity and autism almost sort of amplifying each other, right?
Yeah.
But I want to give you sort of the alternative as well, which came from that study I spoke about where they interviewed the clinicians. And it says, clinicians in both groups identified that an individual's sensory sensitivities could contribute to both difficulties making a transition and to dysphoria. Clinicians tended to focus on the development of gender dysphoria, while adult clinicians focus more on the impact of gender transition. For example, one adult clinician described how taking cross-sex hormones impacted on sensory issues, which, without the clinician having a clear understanding of autism, could have led to a halt of gender treatment. One person who didn't like the feeling when air went across their skin with hair on, so that was the thing that they didn't like about the effects of testosterone. So they would remove their body hair, and you would think, or because you're not happy with the effects of treatment. No, they were happy. They just didn't like it was the flow of air with their skin on.
Flow of air over their skin hair on.
Flow of air. Okay, hold on.
So it's like you've got hairy arms because you're taking testosterone.
The flow of air across their skin with hair on. Yeah, so you know, you see a trans person that you're giving what is it called, hormones to, you know, like a trans guy that you're giving hormones to. He comes on in, and you're like, why have you shaved your body all smooth? Like, do you not like the changes of body hair? Maybe you're not a man. And he's like, I just don't like how the air feels on my skin.
No, I was going to say, like, I really don't like, because when I started testosterone, my skin was, like, really soft, and then it got, like, thicker and harder, and it's, like, sometimes it gets more stuck than before. It's really weird, but, like, that's interesting. That never made me want to stop testosterone.
But this isn't necessarily making you want to stop testosterone.
No, it's just relevant.
So, yeah, it's talking about what I'm kind of getting at here is that if you're treating trans people, right, because we've sort of medicalized transness at this point, if you're treating a trans person and they're autistic, there are going to be, like, there are going to be different things that are going on when compared to non-autistic people, right? So it's less likely for someone that isn't autistic to have sensory issues when it comes to having hair on their skin or feeling air go across their body or feeling their clothes on their body sit differently because, you know, they don't have... Okay, so for example, if you give someone, say, top surgery, right? So you give a trans woman top surgery. She gets a tig old bitties, right? And her tops fit different. And she's like, oh, I don't like how this feels.
Yeah.
It's not that she doesn't like that she's had top surgery. It's that she doesn't like the change in how, like, things fit and feel.
And I feel like it's also, like, in terms of, like, binding. Like, I know a lot of people that just can't bind because they just can't deal with the feeling of, like, that's not just enough. The pain of, like, your chest being strapped down, but, like, the constriction of the binder the fabric.
I can't deal with that.
It's horrible. Like, some of the binders, just, like, it was a struggle every day, like, putting it on, and it took me, like, 30 minutes to get used to just how it feels on your skin. Yeah. Like, there's so many things. That makes a lot. I've never heard anyone speaking about that, though.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of the sensory issues, another thing that autistic people are, or another sort of autistic trait that is fairly well known, is, you know, a need for routine or an enjoyment of routine, right? And I don't know, Noah, you've transitioned your gender, have you not?
Yes.
So did that come with a change in routine at all, or a change in, you know, a change in how your life
went? It was difficult getting blood test booked because I didn't like speaking to people on the phone, so I didn't get my bloods checked and all the stuff. Like, well, I'm on gel now, so, like, I always forget to put my testosterone on, and sometimes I'll see it next to me and be like, I need to put that on, but I'm just like, I don't want the feeling of that. Like, I right. don't, okay, yeah. I don't want to sit all sticky.
Yeah, and so like, so there's things like that, and I've like in these studies, I've read things about, you know, people being like, well, you know, along with transitioning, there's a lot of change to my day-to-day life, right? And that is difficult in and of itself. And if you, this is the difficulty, right? If you don't take into account the totality of someone's experience, you could absolutely misunderstand what's going on with them, like where they're coming from. Because, you know, I mean, like, we've spoken about the sensory processing issues, we could talk about, you know, changes in routine, but ultimately all that comes down to is someone is feeling discomfort. And if you're assuming that they're feeling discomfort with transitioning, then you're gonna have an issue, because that's not where the discomfort is coming from. Yeah. You know, and so I guess the main point here is that taking into account, you know, the overlap of these things is incredibly, incredibly important when it comes to treatment, right? And especially with yourself as well, like internally, trying to understand where your discomfort is coming from. You need to, like, think about that, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it's the same as just, like, seeing a person as a person and not just a diagnosis.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
It's like every person is different. You can't just not consider an aspect of someone's identity or experience.
Mm. And that's kind of pretty much all of the sort of science for today. I kind of want to get on to transphobia and ableism and how the sort of, I mean, how this sort of increased prevalence of autism amongst trans people actually ends up affecting trans and autistic people, whether they're, you know, whether they fall into both categories or not. So this is, again, from elevated rates of autism, other neurodevelopmental and psychiatric diagnoses, and autistic traits in transgender and gender diverse individuals, a paper from 2020 in Nature Communications. That that's the one that was done by Cambridge, if you remember. Yeah. It says, a recent study demonstrated that a third of autistic individuals had their gender identity questioned because they were autistic. There is a need to ensure that autistic, transgender, and gender diverse individuals have the right to express their gender, live with dignity, and receive social and legal recognition of their gender. And what that's kind of pointing out there is that, I mean, if you've managed to miss this, what a lot of sort of transphobes and TERFs specifically will do is say, look at this increase in the number of trans people, and also look at how many trans people are autistic. And they'll then make out the idea that being autistic makes you more vulnerable and incapable of sort of making your own decisions. You know, that very sort of ableist, like, autistic people are basically the big children that don't know how to interact with other people, yeah, right? They'll say that, and then they'll be like, and people like Noah here are then convincing them that they're trans. That's that's what they'll say.
I mean, know? Even then, like, I had a 30-minute video made about me where a woman said that she's like a notorious TERF.
Go ahead and name her if you want.
Oh, Posey Parker made a like 30-minute video about me where she said that I was trans because I was autistic, I was trans because of trauma, I was trans because my parents sent me away to boarding school. It's all these kinds of people that are trying to find reasons as to why I'm trans, rather than just being like, oh, he's just trans. Yeah, right? Like, I've seen a lot of tweets and a lot of articles about it. Like, we should be worried about the rate of trans people that are autistic. It doesn't really matter, like, anyway, like, if someone is trans and autistic. Doesn't matter if being autistic has made them think they're trans, or even if, like, who cares?
When we're talking about adults, we should really be trying to trust that they know what's going on for them, because I just feel like when people say, oh yeah, you know, there's high rates of autism in trans people, people will take that to mean, or they'll twist it to mean, yes, there are high rates of autism in trans people, and that means that every single trans person that is autistic is, like, incapable. Has been tricked, and is like, has, like, because there's not really high functioning and low functioning, you know, obviously, because autism is like a number of sort of different, it's a number of different traits, and, you know, you could have difficulty with one thing and not difficulty with another thing. But these kinds of people that talk about, you know, trans people being autistic and that means that they're not trans, they've just been tricked, they definitely have this view of autism as being sort of high functioning and low functioning, and they'll basically view it as, these are all low functioning autistic people that can't take care of themselves, and they're being taken advantage of.
Yeah,
like it's really horrible and disgusting, just pure ableism and transphobia. And I think it's pretty clear that transphobes like this, they don't really care about anything at all other than just stepping on trans people, right? Like, they will
Where is their activism for all the autistic people who are genuinely being taken advantage of?
in every other way.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, people only care about
autistic people if they're convinced that they're trans.
The only way that autistic people are being taken advantage of is being made into trans people.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's what J.K. Rowling told me.
There's never been an autistic person that's been taken advantage of in any other way.
I cannot imagine a single way that autistic people could be taken advantage of other than transing them, Luke.
Right. But what would be the... Why would you want to trans them?
Trans army.
To remove
and erode women's rights.
Trans army. I love that.
Gender ideology.
To remove women's rights. That's all it is. You know, that's like, I don't really get a lot of this. I mean, I say I don't really get it. Like, I understand it. Like, I understand, you know, the kind of process that leads someone to being this kind of transphobic, this kind of terror. I understand why you would latch on to autism. This autism thing is being a reason for trans people not being valid, despite the fact that, like, the highest numbers that we've got for autism amongst trans people is, like, 26%. Like, that's the absolute highest. All the other ones that I read out, bear in mind, all the other ones I read out were, like, 4 or 5%, which is a bit above, you know, it's quite a bit above the 1 to 2% that we've got in the rest of the population. But let's say you knock out 5% of trans people. You still have 95% of trans people that aren't autistic.
They're the ones who are doing the manipulating of the autistic people.
Yeah.
It takes quite a lot of them to manipulate one autistic person.
Yeah. I actually hashtag all my videos with hashtag autism. Hashtag autistic.
Oh, dear me. Yeah, I think it's really interesting how essentially if you dislike trans people for whatever reason, and I think I've spoken about this before. I feel like the way that a lot of people arrive at that kind of transphobia is there's an initial sort of disgust or discomfort. And we can all feel an initial like sort of disgust or discomfort to something new, right? And not like a sort of conscious one, but like a very sort of like just knee-jerk, like, what is this new thing?
Yeah, yeah.
This makes me uncomfortable. Mm. Or this is not what I'm used to. And I find that kind of like, it's breaking the norms. It's kind of, it makes me feel disgusted, right? We all have those feelings at some point for something, right? And pretending that you don't doesn't make you a better person, just makes you dumb. No, it makes you more likely to overlook when you do have those feelings, right? And if you don't face those feelings that you've got, if you don't face that sort of, like, almost involuntary thing, then you'll just let it sit there and fester. And what people tend to do is try to then justify it. And so instead of thinking, Why do I find trans people uncomfortable? Why does the concept of a trans person make me uncomfortable? Instead of thinking that, like, what's wrong with me? You start thinking, why do trans people make me uncomfortable? What are they doing wrong that's making me uncomfortable?
Why are they doing this deliberately?
Exactly. And so you try to find a reason, like, you know, you go through, you're like, okay, well, maybe science has a reason. Well, maybe trans people make me uncomfortable because, you know, trans women are just men that want to have vaginas for some sexual perversion. And then that gets cast out as like that's not true.
But even if that was the
true
reason, like,
whatever,
who cares?
Does it affect you?
No,
why does that matter?
That one gets him have a pussy. Yeah.
Let him have it.
It's fine. Like, who gets that?
You knock that one out, and then
going to have yours. Don't worry.
Exactly.
Like, bodily autonomy for all except trans people. Apparently,
yeah. Obviously, right?
Obviously, no.
You know, you knock that one out, and then you get onto the autism, and then you're like, oh well, okay, trans people are. Make me uncomfortable because they're not actually trans, and the ones that are actually trans are just tricking autistic people into being trans. Like, it's this never-ending arms race. Like, we could do or say whatever, and we could, you know, do as many studies as we want. We could, you know, come up, we could have, like, you know, a definitive study that says being trans is okay. Like, that couldn't, like, that's not how a study works, but let's say
weird
get a study.
That's the conclusion.
But that's not how a study works, but like, let's say that was like the takeaway from the study. Like there's nothing wrong with being trans, like, what are you talking about, right? These transphobes and TERFs would still find I did a study. I studied an N of one.
Being trans is fine, what are you talking about? Publish in the journal Science.
And these people would still find a reason to invalidate and hate trans people, because ultimately the issue is not anything that trans people are doing or even necessarily anything that trans people are. The issue is just that trans people. There you go. Just that they exist.
Ah, yes.
And if you're constantly looking for a reason to justify something, if you're not looking for actual knowledge, if you're just looking for something to, I guess, justify or back up or corroborate something that you already feel, then you're never gonna actually, you know, have any integrity or come to any decent conclusion. You're never gonna end your crusade against something because you don't care about evidence. TERFs don't care about evidence. TERFs don't care about autistic people and their well-being. They genuinely do not. They just care about making fewer trans people exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, and whether that's through like inciting violence or stopping them from getting the care that they need, it doesn't matter. So don't ever listen to someone saying, oh yeah, like this high prevalence of autism in trans people means that, you know, being trans is this craze and it's blah, 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 blah. Don't ever take that remotely seriously, because like even if being autistic made you more likely to be trans because of like some confusion or whatever, who cares? Trans people are generally happy. Like the sort of, what is it, the detransition rate is ridiculously low. It's all good. It's all fine. Like just leave them alone, back off.
Not sure how many TERFs will be watching this.
I'm gonna have to interview.
Are you kidding me?
No, up until this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's clip this and put it at the start. TERFs, if you're watching this and you're leaving an angry comment calling, I don't know, me a beardist, leftist, misogynist, and calling Noah a woman, just pop in, I don't know, the word cupcake, so we know you've watched this point. Thank you. What? They're not going to watch.
I'm going to go and comment cupcake, just for fun.
Put it this way. Put it this way, my dear TERFs. If you don't put cupcake in your comments, I'm going to delete them. Watch to this point and put cupcake in it, or I'm deleting your comments. Sorry. If you want to be transphobic, you got to say cupcake.
Does that mean if they want to be transphobic and they write cupcake, you'll leave it there?
If they are explicitly... So my actual... I should go through this. That'll be fun. Just really quickly at the end. My actual sort of... not rules, but the guidelines I kind of follow for comment moderation are... I'll allow differences of opinion. I'll allow people to say different things. And often, if I'll just refute them. Because it's fairly easy to do. But if someone is being genuinely trying to harass or being like genuinely cruel or mean or anything like that, specifically to someone in the comments, to a specific person or to a guest, that's gone. I will not tolerate sort of that kind of abuse. If you want to try and discuss why you think what you think, I will leave that up so that people can tell you why you are wrong. But if you're being abusive, then it's gone. So you could put cupcake in with some abuse and that's still going to go. But if you don't have cupcake at all, I'm not leaving any of it in. Sorry.
Cupcake.
Maybe we should do a quick fire quiz. Right?
Dun, 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 dun. Cupcake edition.
So the rules for the quick fire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between the three of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finish asking the question wins. What do they win, Jim?
One cupcake.
And Luke, what is your buzzer?
Donk.
Noah, what's your buzzer?
Bonk.
Jamp, what's your buzzer?
Lonk.
So my question for you today is, roughly what percentage of the population is estimated to be autistic?
Donk. 0.5 to 1.3%.
Oh, that is not correct. Anyone coming in for the steal?
That was also my answer.
1 to 2%.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct.
You
well
buzz,
done.
Though.
Donk, bonk, bonk. One.
Long,
long.
Right. 1 to 2%.
Well, that's one trans exclusionary cupcake for you.
No, no, no. It's a trans exclusionary cupcake.
Oh.
If you have the cupcake, you're allowed to be trans exclusionary.
You're going
to
vomit in 2 minutes.
Reject poison.
But that is not the end, because we need to thank a whole ton of our patrons,
it's that time again.
Because we've had a whole bunch of patrons join us. If you want to support the podcast, if you want to get things like bonus episodes, if you want to get things like bonus clips, if you want to vote on episode topics like this one, or submit episode topics, or even just make us do a topic that you want us to do, get access to special parts of our Patreon, get to see our live show Sly Guys Live whenever you want, and also my favorite thing, get access to After Dark, which is the sister show to this podcast, where we do a little less science and a little bit more philosophy, politics, and all of that lovely stuff, then you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys. But let's get ready to thank all of these brand new patrons. Thank you to Errol Gettner.
Thank you to Ben Clark.
Thank you, Elliot Rock. You rock.
Thank you to Allison Jones.
Thank you to Alex Kobe.
Thank you, Cayenne.
Very spicy. Thank you to Brax.
Thank you, August Slater.
Thank you, Robin Hargreaves.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you, Kendall.
Thank you, Calzilla.
Thank you, Jess Kelly.
Thank you to Ethan Welfner.
Thank you, Lumivarium.
Thank you, Mio003.
Thank you to Elga Lepeshkaita.
Thank you, Hannah7.
Noah, you'll enjoy this one. Thank you to Mimty Lemon.
Mimty. Mimty.
Thank you to T. Smith.
Thanks, Glitch Rabbit, our new executive producer.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you to John Revel.
Thank you to Just Some Sentient Matter.
Thank you to Amelia.
Thank you to Dan the Beetle Man.
Thank you, Lucas.
Thank you to Juliana Moreno.
Thank you to Tiny Pluto.
Thank you, Rita Portugal.
Thank you, Tristan.
Thank you, Freddy.
Thank you, Onyx.
Thank you, Bleached Pants.
Oh, thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Cryptid Flower.
Thank you, Alex Eugene.
Thank you to Maggie Threewitt.
Thank you, Carissa Jordan.
Thank you, Jack Donahue.
Thank you to Frida Roper.
Thank you to Spigasaur.
Thank you to Nix Bowman.
Thank you to Juliet Kratow.
Thank you, Erica Wolf.
Thank you, Green the Color.
Thank you to Andre De Romanis.
Thank you, Brenna W.
And finally, thank you to Christopher.
Wow! Ooh,
so many names this month.
49 new patrons. Wow. Let's see if we can beat that at any point before the end of this year,
50.
Huh?
Oh.
Well, that is it from us. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? Support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys. Or you can find a contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCore everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
You can follow me at NoOffence everywhere except for TikTok, where it's the NoOffence.
And Twitter.
And Twitter, where it's NoOffence Adams.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Pod.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.